And I'd like to introduce Tira, who will tell us to Ctrl-Alt-Delete our anxiety and give us a guide to mental wellness. Good luck, Tira.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. And welcome to my talk, Ctrl-Alt-Delete Anxiety, a Guide to Mental Wellness. My name is Tura van der Knijf, and I'm a second-year psychology student at the University of Utrecht. Before we start, I would like to mention that I am not yet a mental health professional. So I really like to do research and I like to learn, but I'm not equipped to give professional advice. If you're worried about yourself or somebody else, talk to a loved one or your primary care physician. All right, those were the announcements I had to make. Let's begin. I would like to start with a question. Who here gets a little sweaty when thinking about talking to a big group? Hands in the air, please. Yeah, me too. Second question. Who here sometimes worries about things that might possibly go wrong in the future? Hands again. Yeah, look around you. You're definitely not alone. And I can congratulate you because you all have anxiety, which is what we're going to talk about today. Before we start, I would like to shortly introduce why we're going to talk about it, why it is relevant. As you just saw, a lot of people experience anxiety. 40% of Dutch people mention they experience anxiety on a regular, weekly, or daily basis. 43% of US people experience anxiety, and they also experience worsening anxiety. And one in three people, so that's one in three people of this entire room, will experience an anxiety disorder once in their lifetime. All right, so it's really important to talk about anxiety because a lot of us have it. But what are we exactly going to talk about today? We're going to start with what is anxiety. Then how does it happen? How does it work in the brain? Then about neurodivergency and anxiousness. And then last, but my favorite part, tips backed by science. To begin with, what is anxiety? The ABA Dictionary of Psychology defines anxiety as an emotion characterized by apprehension and somatic symptoms of tension. I'm not even going to finish the rest. It's a whole mouthful. Let's break that down a bit. Anxiety is an emotion, which is a state of being. So how are you standing in the world right now? And it's characterized by somatic symptoms. A difficult word, but I can explain it. Somatic symptoms are bodily sensations. So for example, when you have stress, you might feel pressure on your chest, or you might get really warm. Those are somatic symptoms. It's a bit vague still, but I'll go over some examples, and then you'll have a clear picture. To begin with, fear versus anxiety. There is a really clear distinction, which is, fear has one trigger and is a short burst of emotion, and anxiety usually has more than one trigger, or it's not really clear, and it's for a longer period of time, so hours, days, sometimes even weeks. Although there is definitely something that defines them both, they are used interchangeably often because the underlying mechanism is often the same. I will get into that later. We are going to practice with making this distinction, and I have two examples for you. The first one is that you're on a safari in Africa. It's really cool, you're driving around in a big jeep, and then all of a sudden, a tiger comes at you. Who here thinks this is anxiety? Hands, please. Nobody? You are all correct. This is a really great example of fear, because it has one trigger, it's a short burst of emotion, and so it doesn't last weeks, days, any longer. The second example I have is you've decided with a couple of your friends that you're going to walk in the forest, and it's the night before, and now you're laying awake because there might be ticks. Who here thinks this is anxiety? These people are correct. There's not one trigger before you because you're in your bed. There are no ticks. And it's usually longer, you're worrying for a bit. It's not a short burst of emotion. All right, that was the distinction between fear and anxiety, which I thought was important to highlight because there is definitely a difference, and anxiety is usually a bit more impactful because it lasts longer. Now, what is normal anxiety versus an anxiety disorder? Because this is also an important difference to make. Normal anxiety almost everybody has, and it's actually made to keep us safe. Think of the tiger I mentioned before. The reaction that happens, which is your heart goes faster, you get warm, your muscles get ready to respond, that is made to keep you safe so you can run away faster. Anxiety is kind of like that instinct, but developed a bit further, and it can still be really beneficial. Think of when you have to give a presentation at work, and because you're a bit anxious about how it might go, you actually prepared really well. Or if you have an important exam, or for example, let's say you run a marathon and you're a bit nervous the night before, that nervousness actually makes your body ready for the task at hand. So anxiety is not always bad, but even if it's not a disorder, it can still be really debilitating. Then now, when is it a disorder? Normal anxiety becomes a disorder for a whole list of reasons. I will highlight a couple. The first being, if you cannot get rid of it on your own. If you have anxiety, but you cannot cope, nothing you try to get rid of it works, I would call your primary care physician to see, like, hey, is there maybe something going on here? The second one, and also the last maybe important one, is if you're having panic attacks. If you're having panic attacks, that is not falling under the scope of normal anxiety. So again, reach out then. But even if you don't have an anxiety disorder, or you can cope a little bit, normal anxiety can still be really annoying, and that's why I'm talking about it today. All right, we've talked a bit about what anxiety is, and I hope you all have a clear picture now about what it entails, and we'll go on to the next part. How does it happen? As with everything in psychology, there are many theories and perspectives. The two broadest ones are the biological perspectives and the psychological perspectives, under which a whole lot of theories fall. I'll highlight a couple. To begin with, the biological perspective. The biological perspective has, like I mentioned, a couple of theories. One being that everything that happens in your brain is because of the anatomy. So this theory states that if you experience a lot of anxiety, it must be because the anxiety part of your brain is bigger than someone else's. Another theory in the biological perspective is the neurochemical theory, which states that if you're experiencing a lot of anxiety, it's probably because you have a lot of anxiety chemicals in your head. Then the psychological perspectives. Like I mentioned, there are also a lot of theories which fall underneath one, but I would highlight the most important one for anxiety, which is behaviorism. Behaviorism states that all anxiety is learned. All right, sounds a bit vague. I'll give an example. Let's say you're really afraid of bunnies, and every time you see that cute little hairy thing, you get panicky. Behaviorism thinks that is because you had a really not good experience with a bunny when you were small or before. And because of that, you might have gotten bitten, or you might have gotten really scared while you were close to a bunny. Because of that experience, your mind has learned bunnies equal fear. And so now, even though you're not in that situation anymore, your brain still relates those bunnies with fear, and then you're afraid. You might be asking, well, Tura, which one is right? And I have a bit of a disappointing answer. Like with most things in psychology, there's not one theory that is absolutely all-encompassing. We now know that all of these things are all a little bit true, and together they form how anxiety works. I know, not as a bit disappointing, but what we do have is a really good model of anxiety. A model is basically, how can we get this really abstract concepts and make it like really understandable? And for anxiety, we have the 3C model. This is called the 3C model because it has 3 concepts, and I'll take you through them now. The first one is thoughts. What I forgot to mention before, all these 3 components, they interact with each other, and that forms anxiety. Sounds a bit fake, I know, but we'll give some examples and then you will understand, I hope. To begin with thoughts, let's take the example of speaking in front of a big crowd. You might have thoughts like, I'm really going to fail. Nothing is ever going to be good after that. We call that catastrophizing. Or either I will be perfect or it will be really, really bad. We call those black and white thinking. Usually with anxiety, these are thoughts of failure, thinking about all the things that could go wrong, and also usually they're in a really big loop. So it's not just one thought of, I will do it wrong, but you think it will go wrong, and then everybody will laugh at me, and they think I'm stupid. You get the gist. Then the feelings part. What I mean with feelings is that physical sensation of anxiety. For some people, it's that get really warm. Some people feel it in their chest. Some people feel it in their legs. But that physical sensation. And at this point, I will talk about what happens in the brain, because actually, it's something that happens in your brain that causes that physical reaction. I'll take you through it. To begin, that feeling in your body begins with sensory input. This can be seeing a snake, or this can be the thought of, I have to give a presentation, because thoughts can actually influence what you feel in your body. So it begins with sensory input. This, through a whole lot of different brain regions, which I won't mention because we don't have a lot of time, it goes to the amygdala. The amygdala is a part of your brain you can blame your anxiety on. It's the fear center in the brain. The amygdala has two little helpers that help it decide if they should be afraid or if they should not be afraid, like simplified. The first helper is the prefrontal cortex. I don't know. The prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex is the logic thinking part of your brain. So when taking the presentation example, the prefrontal cortex might say, well, you did practice for hours, so you're gonna be fine. And the other helper from the amygdala is the hippocampus. The hippocampus is the memory part of the brain. Remember the bunny I told you about before? The hippocampus is actually the one that remembers that little biting incident. But in our case, with the presentation example, the hippocampus might tell the amygdala, well, last time you did a presentation, and it was fine, so nothing to worry about now. All right, the amygdala makes a decision, and then it gets sent to the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus, I kind of think of as the little factory manager. So it tells other parts of the brain what, like, hey, we're low on this hormone, or hey, we're low on this chemical. The hypothalamus, when getting told by the amygdala, like, hey, tell your people to produce some of this, has two options. Either there's an immediate fear reaction, for example, with the tiger, and then it gets sent exactly to the part I'm going to tell you about later. And it uses a couple of neurotransmitters, which are neurochemicals. It uses norepinephrine, epinephrine, acetylcholine, I don't know the English word for this, and many more. Or it can use the longer road. So let's say you have a presentation. You don't need to be afraid right now at this moment because there's not a threat in front of you. But you do need to be a bit stressed, or so the amygdala thinks. And then it uses the HPA axis. And the HPA axis also uses chemicals to tell other parts of the brain what to do, but it doesn't use norepinephrine and epinephrine, it uses cortisol. All right, so the hypothalamus has two ways, the slow way and the highway, and both send signals to the sympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system is every part of your body that is responsible for the fight or flight response. Sounds a bit fake. I'll give an example again. The hypothalamus has sent, for example, epinephrine, and then the sympathetic nervous sees that epinephrine and thinks, oh, epinephrine, now I have to raise the heartbeat. I have to send more blood to muscles. I have to stop digestion because we don't need it right now, because now we need to fight or flight. It quickens breathing, all those things. Right, and then because of the sympathetic nervous system does all those things, like quickening heartbeats, stopping digestion, and everything else I just mentioned, that produces that feeling in your body. That warmth you feel is because the sympathetic nervous system tells your body to do that. All right, so this is a bit of an explanation about how you go from sensory input, like the thought of a presentation, through the brain to the actual stressed feeling in your body. I mentioned before that fear and anxiety are different concepts, but they have the same workings underneath them. This is what I meant. So fear takes the same route, and anxiety also. All right, so we've talked about the thoughts part of anxiety and the feelings part of anxiety. Let's go to the next part, or the last part, the behavior part. What we mean with behavior is everything that you do differently because you feel anxious, and then because you do that differently, you might feel more anxious. So behavior that we see mostly with anxiety is avoidance. So I'm stressed about the presentation, let's just tell my coworkers to do that. Or I'm afraid of ticks, maybe I won't go to the forest. And another behavior we see, so we see avoidance, but we also see over-preparation, so a safeguarding behavior. Let's say if I'm stressed for a presentation, I'll practice for hours and hours and hours until I can dream it, and that keeps me safe. And all of the things I just mentioned interact with each other. So let's say you have a thought, I'm scared of the presentation. Well, let's not do it. But because we don't do it, we feel anxious because maybe our coworker thinks we're weird. And now we have more thoughts and more feelings. And it all interacts to create anxiety. All right. We now have talked about what is anxiety and about how anxiety happens. We're going to the next part, neurodivergent and anxious. Neurodivergency is an umbrella term used to describe that different developments in the brain, that it's not that per se a bad thing, but it just reflects normal differency in brains. For example, under the neurodivergent umbrella fall things like ADHD, autism, Tourette's, dyslexia, dyspraxia, all different kinds of disorders that people could have, or things that are a bit different in their brain, that makes their cognitive development a little bit different. But why should we talk about neurodivergency and anxiety? Well, we're talking about it because there's a really big link. Neurodivergent people are way more anxious than people who are not neurodivergent. There's a lot, and even more research to show this link. I'll give some statistics to prove it. People who have autism have about a 40% chance of experiencing anxiety disorder once in their lifetime, which is 10% more than people who are not autistic. People with a sensory processing disorder have are four times more likely to develop an anxiety disorder in their lifetime. And 50% of people with ADHD will experience anxiety in their lifetime. Why is this? We don't exactly know. Neurodivergency is a really broad umbrella, and so to do research for that entire umbrella is almost impossible. There are a couple theories, however. The first one is uncertainty and change. We know that from research that uncertainty and change is a really big contributing factor to anxiety in non-neurodivergent people, and neurodivergent people even have usually a lot more difficulty with uncertainty and change. So it's hypothesized that because that like counts up, that's why people, neurodivergent people, get more anxious. The second one is social difficulties. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where you were like, I have no idea what to do. That creates a lot of anxiety. Neurodivergent people are more often in those kind of situations, especially in social settings, than people who are not neurodivergent. So then you get more anxiety. And the last theory is brain chemistry. We know that some conditions which fall under the neurodivergent umbrella change brain chemistry. For example, if you have ADHD, your dopamine is a bit differently regulated. And dopamine and other neurochemicals can play a big role in anxiety. So if your dopamine is different, then it might also be different in the case of anxiety. All right, we've talked a bit about neurodivergent and anxious, and now onto my favorite part, the tips backed by science. Here I'll also give a tip for people who experience neurodivergency or who fall under that umbrella. When I was researching for tips, I had a couple of things in mind. The tips I want to give you have to be well-researched and effective, because that's really important. I can't just tell you things which we don't know if they work. The second one is I also want them to work without a therapist. I do have to give a bit of a disclaimer. There's a whole lot less research for anxiety interventions without a therapist. So the tips I give you are researched, but it is important to keep that in the back of your head, like, hey, this is more effective when I do it without a therapist, and it might not work because I'm not doing it with a therapist. And then the last but not least thing I want to mention before we get into my tips section is that everything you want to change about how your mind works takes a lot of time, patience, and practice. It can take weeks, months, sometimes even years, to change the way your mind works, because our mind is our mind for years and years and years at this point, and so changing something can be really difficult. All right, on to the fun part. I want to begin with lifestyle. It might sound boring, but there's a lot of research that backs up that your lifestyle has to do a lot with how you experience anxiety. The first factor I want to mention is sleep. Sleep and anxiety, you might have experienced it, are a really vicious cycle. People who are anxious worry and they sleep less. We know this, data shows. And then when you don't sleep a lot, research also shows that you're more prone to anxiety. And then you have anxiety and you sleep less, and then you sleep even less, and then because you're sleepless, you get more anxious, and yeah, not a fun circle to be in. But I have three tips to break this circle. To begin with, relaxation techniques. You might have heard this a lot of times, say just, oh, just relax. But research actually shows that people who meditate before bed, so they take 5 minutes to just be in the present, or people who listen to guided audios, they actually sleep better even if they're anxious. The second tip is good sleep hygiene. Sleep hygiene is not about if you shower before you go to bed. It is about your routine surrounding sleep. So no screens before bed. I know this is difficult for computer nerds, but try. Go to sleep in a dark room, go to sleep in a cold room, and there are a whole lot more tricks. If you experience sleep and anxiety, I would really recommend, after my talk, because I don't have time to cover everything, Google sleep hygiene and try some things. You never know what works. The last tip I want to give you regarding sleep and anxiety are the 10 worry minutes, or 5, or 15, whatever you want to make of it. And it's basically where you tell yourself, you know what, I'm allowed to worry a lot right now. You can write everything down, you can say everything out loud. You're just allowing your mind to run. And then after those 10 minutes, you stop. I know it sounds really easy to say, but with a lot of practice, research actually shows that this can really help people with their anxiety, because you are allowed that worry, and then you worry, and then at one point, it kind of runs out. All right, those were my tips for sleep and anxiety. I really recommend go to your tent tonight, try them out, and hopefully you have a good night's sleep. This last lifestyle tip I want to give has to do with physical activity. And I know I told you I wouldn't tell you to go for a run, and I won't, but research shows that physical activity is really, really beneficial because of a couple reasons, three of which I have highlighted. The first is cognition, which is a fancy word for thinking. Physical activity actually empties your mind, literally. People who have exercised, sometime after that, they have less worrying and racing thoughts in their head. The second one has to do with brain chemistry. Physical activity releases endorphins, which are feel-good hormones. And so when you do physical activity, those little things in your brain actually tell your brain, like, hey, it's okay, we're allowed to be happy now. And so then you have less anxiety. And the last one is coping. Research also shows that people who do physical activity at least once or twice a week are way better at coping with difficult situations than people who don't exercise. So if you have a regular exercise routine, so let's say you go for a run or you go to dance for twice a week, you actually are way better at coping. For example, if somebody passes away, or if you have something, you're moving to a different country or anything like that, if you do physical activity, you're better equipped to handle those feelings. All right, that was the little lifestyle part, and we'll now go on to the last part of my tips, which has to do with cognitive behavioral therapy. I mentioned this triangle before, the three component theory. And cognitive behavioral therapy is a therapy that states that if you interrupt one of the three components, then the circle doesn't really work anymore, and so your anxiety lessens. Cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT as I will call it from now on, is the most well-researched therapy there is for anxiety. It is the golden standard in the industry, so to say. And today I've brought you a couple of things you can do from the therapy, because I can't just give a whole room of people therapy in 25 minutes, that you can apply directly into your daily life. The first one has to do with the thoughts component, because what we're going to do now is we're going to learn strategies to interrupt one of the three components. The first one is thoughts. The strategy I'm going to teach you is called cognitive restructuring. And when I tell you how it works, you might think that's never going to work. It will. But it, like I mentioned before, it will take a lot of practice and patience. Cognitive restructuring is usually done in three steps. The first one is identifying the thought. Because what we're going to do is we're going to try to take that thought and replace it with a more positive one. And that will also change the rest of the triangle to be more positive. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to identify our difficult thoughts. Taking the presentation example again, I might think, well, I'm going to fail really badly. I'm saying it out loud because that helps me identify the thought, for example. But you can also write it down or keep a little diary at night of what you have felt during the day in stressful situations and what you were thinking back then. I really recommend doing that. The second step, once we have noticed which thoughts are making us anxious, we're going to challenge the thought. So we're going to try to prove it wrong. This can be really difficult because if you're anxious, you're just thinking in circles. But I also have a trick for that. And the trick I like to call pretend you're in a courtroom. So you are going to pretend you're in a courtroom, and then somebody else says, I'm going to fail the presentation really bad. And you, as like a lawyer or a judge, you're going to try to disprove them by maybe saying, no, you're not, because you've practiced. How could you fail? You've done this really a lot of times before. You have recently taken a training in public speaking. You'll be fine. So you're going to challenge that thought. And then once you've challenged it, and there's maybe you're maybe a bit more convinced of like, well, I could, the thought could be right, it could be wrong, you're going to replace the thought with a more positive one. This can also be difficult to come up with because when you're anxious, you're just thinking really negatively. But I have two tips for this. The first one is the best friend voice. You're going to imagine somebody else said a mean thing to you. So your best friend said about her presentation, I'm going to fail horrendously. And then you're going to try to comfort that friend. So to, like, again, you're good at presenting, you're going to be fine, things like that. And the second trick I have is called outside attributing. And this mostly works for thoughts that have to do with social anxiety. So let's say you're in a social environment and you're thinking, well, these people really don't like me because they're doing a bit weird. They're not really looking at me much or something like that. Well, you're first going to identify the thought, like, these people hate me. You're going to challenge it, come up with some ways it might not be true, and then you're going to replace it. And for that, we can use the trick outside attributing, which entails that you're going to try to find a reason why these people are behaving that like this that is outside of yourself. I'll give another example. Let's say I'm thinking, like I mentioned, these people hate me because they're not looking at me. I'm going to think of reasons why they are not looking at me for other reasons. Maybe they had a bad night's sleep. Maybe there's fireworks outside, so obviously no one's interacting with me. Maybe their dog just died. Maybe they got fired this morning. Things like that. And so you place the problem outside of yourself. All right, those are the three steps for cognitive restructuring. And by doing these, hopefully, you can break the thought part of the triangle. Let's move on to the feelings part of anxiety, feeling part of the triangle. There are two tricks for this, again. And with feeling, like I mentioned, I mean the physical feeling in your body. What you're going to do to get rid of this feeling caused by that sympathetic nervous system I mentioned before is to activate the opposite of the sympathetic nervous system, which is called the parasympathetic nervous system. This is the calming nervous system. It's the rest and digest nervous system. I have two techniques to try this. The first one we're going to practice together, and it's called box breathing. It basically means that you breathe in for a couple of seconds. I'm going to use four. Hold that breath, breathe out again, and then hold that again. So you've had a breath in a box. All right, want to try it together? Let's breathe in for four. One, two, three, four. Hold it. Two, three, four. Breathe out. Two, three, four, and hold it. Two, three, four. Okay. You had a breath in a box, congratulations. If you do this a couple times, your parasympathetic nervous system gets activated because it basically tells your body, hey, we're safe, it's okay. The second tip I have to activate the parasympathetic nervous system is especially if you're neurodivergent, and it's called sensory grounding. Grounding is the practice of getting back into the present moment, getting back into your body. And we can do this using our senses. So a trick might be to look at things you see, but what works even better, especially if you sometimes have sensory issues, is using touch and smell. So let's say I'm anxious in a social situation, I might touch like a really soft sweater, or you can use a smell you really like, and that also gets you back into present moments. The second tip I have for the feelings part is moving. And only 7 to 10 minutes gets that parasympathetic nervous system activated and calms down. You can go for a walk or like vacuum, but what I like even better is Just Dance. Only 2 Just Dance numbers will have your parasympathetic nervous system activated and that anxiety will have left your body. All right, that was the feelings part. Let's move on to the last part. I'm almost finished, I promise. The behavior part. Like I mentioned before, a behavior that we see really often with anxiety is avoidance. People avoid the things they're afraid of. The tip I have might not be a fun tip while you're doing it, but it will really, really help. And it is called exposure. Exposure is basically doing the thing you're afraid of so that your body learns like you're not going to die or you're not going to be attacked by anybody while you're doing this, so it is safe. There are a lot of ways to do exposure, but I will highlight the two easiest. The first one is called graded exposure. And what you do, you make a list of the things you're anxious about. And then you start with the smallest thing. For example, if I really don't like calling people, I will practice sending a text first. And then try that until I don't feel anxious. And then maybe I'll send an email. And then I'll call a friend who I already really like. And when that all is easy, then I will call my coworker, which I'm afraid of. The second one, type of exposure therapy I want to highlight is called systemic desensitization. And it's a bit of a difficult technique, but it can really help. And what you do is you, again, make a list of what you're anxious about. For example, let's say phone calls. And you're going to start with just thinking about the phone call. And then you're going to do relaxation exercises. All right, when you are not anxious anymore when thinking about a phone call, you're going to hold a physical telephone. And you're also going to do relaxation exercises. And then you're maybe going to call a friend and do relaxation exercises while you're doing that. And by going in really slow steps while doing relaxation exercises, your body learns like, hey, it's safe. Nobody is going to attack me. All right, that was almost everything I wanted to say. I'll give a short recap. We have talked about what exactly is anxiety. We've seen that it is emotion, which often comes with a lot of physical sensations. We have seen how it happens in the brain, how it goes from just something sensory to an actual feeling in our body. And we've also seen that it has usually three different components. We have learned that neurodivergent people are a lot more anxious than non-neurodivergent people, and we don't exactly know why, but we have a couple of theories. And then last but not least, I took you through some lifestyle changes and CBT techniques that might help you calm down. I've piqued your interest and you want to learn more about anxiety, I read a bunch of books to prepare for this talk, and the best ones, I think, personally, were called Goede Moed. It is only in Dutch, sadly. And it's not just about regular anxiety, but also about like climate anxiety. The second one is Feel the Fear and Do It Anyways. It has to do a lot with exposure. And if you're not really a reader, I recommend the Netflix show The Mind Explains. This goes really into that neurochemistry part, and it's just a really, really good TV show. All right, if you have any questions, I don't know if we have time for them, but you can also email me. Thank you.
Thank you, Tura. We do have some time for questions. If you're still okay, the next speaker is at 12. So I was thinking like sleeping less gives more anxiety. That's challenging here. So maybe we have to get some physical movement and run to the silent lounge. That's probably the best thing to do. That's the recap I got from that. A Q&A.
Hi.
Oh, hi. So you were talking about fear and you were talking about anxiety.
Yeah.
Where would you put panic in relation to that and linking to them both?
Yeah, great question. I don't have any research on the top of my mind to say it, but when I think personally, I think panic is definitely in the fear part, But sometimes when you can start with anxiety and it can go to fear, but without a trigger, and I think that's called panic. So like fear is like if you have a snake in front of you and then you get like that feeling, and anxiety is if there's no snake, but if you get that fear without a trigger, like without the snake being in front of you, that might like constitute as panic. So I think it's a bit of both, to recap. Oh. Does that answer your question?
Yep, I think so.
Yeah. Okay.
Good enough.
Hi. Hi. Can you hear me?
Please talk very close to the microphone.
Yeah. Hi. So I was wondering if you could give some practical advice, even though you mentioned that it takes time for the mind to change, of course, but in myself at least, I also get anxious about my symptoms of anxiety. Like I start speaking very fast and people judge me because they think I'm too hyper and so that kind of thing.
I have maybe one or two tips, but it can be really difficult. Someone once mentioned to me, if you look around in your own environment, do you ever notice that people right now here are really panicky? I personally have not noticed that anyone here is panicky, while research says that a couple of people should be. So you cannot see it in other people, so that thought, at least for me, it can comfort that other people won't see it, because you cannot. I've never seen like an actual panicky person in public, and they are there. Another tip that might work, but I really recommend only doing this with a therapist, it's called exposure flooding, and it's basically where you take exposure therapy, and you're going to do the thing you're the most afraid of, but it can also make it way worse, so please only do this with a therapist. But basically what you're going to do is you're going to be really, really, really afraid, so you maybe have a panic attack in front of a therapist, and then your body learns, like, it's fine, I'm still going to survive. But it is, like I mentioned, it's only used in therapeutic practice, so please don't do this by yourself, but it might be worth looking into if you have that often.
Thank
Does
you.
That help?
Yeah, of course. Okay. And if you don't mind also, since you mentioned the therapy, you earlier mentioned CBT, right?
Yeah.
And I was wondering what are your opinions on schema therapy, because I've read about it recently, and it seems very interesting for other also what you would call in your field maladaptive responses to learned behavior from like childhood and so on, right?
Your question is regarding schema therapy and if I think it could be applied. Because cognitive behavioral therapy is like the most researched therapy, I put it in here, so I didn't read a lot about schema therapy. But what I do know is there's more research being done, and for some people it really helps, and other people in the field are still a bit like, because it's like an overflying trend, it's really popular in the USA and in research there, but not so much in Europe yet. But it can be definitely worth looking into, but I don't have an exact opinion yet because the field is still a bit undecided.
Okay, thank you very much.
Oh, well, you're welcome.
I also had a question about CBT.
Please talk very close to the microphone.
Yeah, so the camera can hear.
Very sensitive microphone.
Yes. Could you go back to the CBT thought slide, maybe?
Yes.
So at the very start, you said that anxiety isn't necessarily unreasonable, right? It can have a very reasonable source.
So that if you mean like I mentioned that anxiety thoughts can be challenged.
Like, thoughts can come from, from a source where it's, like, reasonable to have the anxiety or the fear.
So I mentioned that some thoughts are not reasonable, so they're not backed by logic, do you mean?
Yeah, and other thoughts are reasonable.
Yeah.
So I was wondering what your thoughts were on this, how that is in relation with this, if you have a reasonable anxious thoughts, or there is some reasonability in it?
Yeah. So I think your question is, if there's a thought that is reasonable, for example, I'm afraid of presentations because I really did my last one really badly, how you can still use this, or if you should even use this.
Yeah, like I've heard criticism that then you are here saying like, oh, that thought is bad, and you should replace it with a good one, but maybe it won't be a good one, for example.
Well, I never really think thoughts are definitely necessarily bad, but it can make anxiety worse. I'm not really sure, but I think from a personal perspective, maybe you can think like, okay, maybe it is a reasonable thought, but at the same time, it makes me anxious, which is almost never really helpful. But if you notice that, and then I can change the thought, but if your anxiety is helpful to you, I would say just ignore this technique and keep being as anxious as is comfortable for you.
Right.
So I think even if it's reasonable, if the anxiety bothers you, you should try to lessen that anxiety because it's not helping you. But if the anxiety is helping you, then just ignore this.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know if that kind of answered your question.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Do we have any questions from the signal angels? Nothing, okay?
Yeah.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Yes, thanks. So I was wondering...
You can move the microphone up. Yeah. So you, yes.
So I was wondering, in case of the bunny that bit you, what's the difference between anxiety that develops and a phobia?
That's a really, really great question. So he's asking what the difference is between anxiety and a phobia. And phobias can... fall under the umbrella of anxiety. So for example, if you have a specific anxiety that is a specific phobia that's really debilitating, in like the diagnostic manual for psychiatry, it's still under the anxiety category. But a specific phobia is really one specific thing. And anxiety, you probably know, but a specific phobia is one thing, for example, the bunny, and anxiety is usually more general, but because it's kind of like the same processes in the diagnostic statistics manual, they are still under the same category.
So like the phobia would be, I'm scared of rabbits, of bunnies, and the anxiety would be, ooh, animals.
A better example might be, a phobia is I'm really afraid of bunnies, and anxiety comes with that. So you might be afraid to go to the zoo because there might be bunnies, and then that feeling is anxiety. So that's why they're skilled together in the diagnostics manual, because a phobia comes with anxiety. But anxiety is if you don't have the bunny right in front of you. Does that explain it a bit?
That explains it really well. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, last question.
Let's say you're giving a presentation. Playing Just Dance might not be feasible at that moment in time.
Yes.
do you have any tips to deal with that in a moment?
Yes, I definitely have. I also don't play Just Dance for presentations. I don't know if you saw me in the corner. I wasn't like, I would recommend trying any other technique to calm that parasympathetic nervous system. So there is a whole bunch of techniques. If you're interested, I really recommend Googling them, because you could talk hours about them. But a technique that might work is the breathwork thing I mentioned. So either a triangle breath, or there are like guided things you can do, or there are certain techniques with like breathing out in short bursts that might help. Or another one is that you're tensing and then releasing. And I think that could be like a more undercover way to calm that nervous system down.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Then give a big hand for Tira van der Kneip.